This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Hard as it may be to imagine, the situation in the Darfur region of Sudan is getting worse. The on-again, off-again peace talks between government officials and Darfur rebels are off again as of today. And today, the British aid organization Save the Children said it will pull all of its staff from Darfur, that after four of its workers were killed there over the past 2 months. The number displaced from their homes in Darfur has now reached over 1.5 million. Many, in desperate need of food, shelter, and medical supplies, flee to refugee camps in neighboring Chad. And estimates of the number killed range from 70,000 to 350,000. But despite cries of genocide, despite repeated discussions at the United Nations Security Council, despite efforts to engage the African Union and the Arab League, killing and rape continue, and hundreds of villages in Darfur lie in ashes. Later in the program, a new movie looks back on genocide in Rwanda. We'll talk with the man who managed the Hotel Rwanda. But first, the crisis in Darfur. If you have questions about what happened and why, or about what the U.S., Europe, and the rest of the world should do now, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. Reporter Jonah Fisher joins us now. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Good afternoon.
First of all, can you tell us about the announcement today with the end of the peace talks? This was a fragile process to begin with.
Yeah, it was a fragile process that has been going on for some time in Nigeria. The Abuja process, there's been a number of rounds there. And the third round, this round in December, has broken up today, basically because both sides wouldn't stop fighting. The African Union, who are in charge of these peace talks, put an ultimatum on both parties at the weekend saying, you've got to stop fighting or else there's no point in us talking. And basically, the sides didn't stop fighting. So the talks have now been put off until January, when it's hoped the situation will be better on the ground.
If those talks are to resume and progress at all, do both sides have to stop fighting?
Yeah, well, I think that's the first condition which is being laid down for them. The African Union mission here isn't a peacekeeping mission. It's an observer mission. It's supposed to be observing a ceasefire. Now, that ceasefire only really exists in name alone. So in order for any progress to be made on achieving a political solution in which the Darfur rebels can be in any way satisfied with what they get out of the process, the violence has to stop first before they can sit around the table.
And if today's announcement by Save the Children is any indication, they may fear that violence is going to continue or maybe even worsen.
Well, things have been getting progressively worse for aid agencies over the last few months. Agreements have been signed about humanitarian access and security, but the actual reality on the ground is that it's getting more and more dangerous for them to try and deliver aid and food supplies to these 1.5 million people who've been displaced from their homes. Save the Children have had a particularly bad run of luck, one could say, that four of their staff have died in just over 2 months. Two of them were brutally killed about 10 days ago. They were shot by the roadside in Darfur, despite having driven around in clearly marked humanitarian vehicles.
And rebels in Darfur also continue their attacks.
Yes, the fighting that's going on in Darfur at the moment is a direct confrontation between the government and the rebels. And the rebels are also strongly linked with the looting and banditry which is taking place against aid convoys. So there's no real good guys here in the sense that both the government and the rebels are violating the ceasefire on a daily basis.
Under pressure from, among others, the United States, the government in Sudan said it would do its best to stop these Janjaweeds, as they're called, these gangs that were armed by the government and, at least according to eyewitness reports of people who've been in the region, attack in concert with government aircraft.
That's right. I was in Darfur last week. I'm in the capital, Khartoum, now. But people who flee, who were fleeing the villages where attacks were taking place, were bringing stories of the so-called Janjaweed and the government acting in fairly close cooperation with each other, of Janjaweed coming into villages and then shortly afterward, government forces also moving in. It's impossible to verify those stories, but that's what the people who are fleeing into the refugee camps are saying.
Now, at the same time, this situation continues in Darfur. There is another set of peace talks underway in Sudan. This is called the so-called North-South peace talks. Tell us what's going on there.
That's right. This is a much more optimistic story. There's been a 21-year war going on in Sudan between the north and south. The north is mainly Arab, the south mainly black African. And there's been a 2.5-year long process going on in Kenya. And as you may remember, an agreement was signed at the United Nations Security Council about a month ago that a deal would be signed before the end of the year, a final settlement to that conflict between the north and the south. And so now we're just waiting to see, really, whether they honour that agreement and do actually put pen to paper before the end of the year, or whether it will spill forward into 2005.
The United States has been very involved in these North-South talks and trying to resolve that long-running civil war, some critics say, to the detriment of the situation in Darfur.
Well, the United States has had a long history of involvement in trying to bring a solution to the North-South problem. The Darfur problem has been very much handed to the African Union as a trial for their attempts to bring African solutions to African problems. The idea was that they would be the mission on the ground, they would be in charge of the peace process, and they would show to the rest of the world that Africa can start tackling its own problems. As events have transpired, it doesn't seem to be working out that way, and it seems quite likely that this will be taken back to the United Nations Security Council, who will once again have to reflect on what more they can do to help the situation in Darfur. Mm-hmm.
Jonah Fisher, I know it's late where you are. Thanks very much for staying up to speak with us.
Thank you.
Jonah Fisher, a freelance journalist based in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, which is where we reached him. By the way, if you'd like to join this conversation about the crisis in Darfur, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. In the meantime, we return to Khartoum to talk with an aid worker whose organization has been trying to bring some relief to the thousands of displaced people in Sudan. Adrian McIntyre works for Oxfam, an international aid organization. He joins us by phone from Khartoum. And again, we know it's late. Thanks for staying up to speak with us.
You're very welcome.
What is it like to try to get food and medical supplies and clean water to so many people in such a remote place?
Well, it's incredibly difficult, not only because the situation in Darfur is deteriorating in terms of security, as you've just heard. It's very dangerous to work in, and Darfur is also an enormous area, roughly the size of France. And as you've mentioned, there are more than 1.5 million people who have been driven from their homes by the fighting over the past 18 months. They're now scattered throughout this area, some of them clustered in extensively overcrowded camps, others of them hiding in very remote areas, and another 200,000 fled across the border into Chad. Now, Oxfam is one of the few humanitarian aid agencies working in all three Darfur states and also in Chad, and we see that the situation on the ground remains very precarious. There are hundreds of thousands of people who live in miserable conditions, insufficient food, water, shelter, sanitation, medicine, basically you name it, these people need it. And the remoteness of some of the areas and the continued fighting and insecurity makes it very difficult for aid agencies to deliver this life-saving assistance.
Is distance and the scattering of the population, is that the most difficult problem you face right now?
No, certainly at the moment, the continued fighting and insecurity are what pose the greatest danger to aid workers and to civilians living in these terrible conditions alike. There are many roads throughout Darfur that are too dangerous to travel on, and so now many aid agencies are having to resort to UN helicopters to reach some of the more remote areas. There's also a difficulty with shipping material supplies, vital aid equipment, food, medicine, and so on over the roads because of the banditry that continues to plague the region.
Mm-hmm. Banditry, is either side to blame for this or are both?
Well, again, as Jonah Fisher just explained, there's even more than just two sides. Certainly various rebel groups plus government forces plus organized militias and perhaps even some local thugs who are taking advantage of the absence of law and order and exploiting the situation to their advantage. Certainly what is needed most of all by people in Darfur is an immediate end to this violence and an effort by all parties to negotiate a peaceful settlement that will bring some law and order to the region. That's the most desperate thing that is needed at the moment.
As you look ahead, one of the problems always you have to worry about as people are displaced is disease. And another problem you have to worry about, of course, is nutrition. Have these people been able to plant the crops they may depend on for next year?
As a matter of fact, they have not. The fighting that has continued over the past 6 to 8 months in Darfur, with various peaks and valleys, and we're unfortunately in a situation at the moment where the fighting has been on the increase steadily over the past month. This insecurity has prevented many people from planting the crops that are needed, and a short and insufficient rainy season also didn't provide adequate water for those crops to flourish. In many areas now, there are serious food shortages and widespread crop failures throughout both Darfur and eastern Chad. People simply don't have enough food, and the UN is estimating that more than 2.5 million people are going to need food assistance in the coming months.
So famine is as well as all the other problems.
That is a serious threat. And of course, when people are living in very crowded conditions with insufficient clean water and sanitation, there's a threat to the public health situation in those areas. High rates of malnutrition and disease are being reported throughout Darfur. Numerous cases of bloody diarrhea and waterborne diseases such as hepatitis E. This is where Oxfam is doing its work to try to improve the public health situation by providing clean water, by providing sanitary facilities, and also hygiene education, public health education for communities to learn how to improve the situation for them and their families.
You've provided a vivid picture of the scale of the problem and the needs involved, yet we do hear word today that Save the Children is pulling out. Is that discouraging?
Well, we certainly, our sympathy is with Save the Children and, of course, with the families and colleagues of staff members that have been killed in the past few months. We understand how difficult it must have been for the organization to reach the conclusion that they needed to pull out of Darfur. In fact, Save the Children and Oxfam both have been working in Darfur for over 20 years. We've worked quite closely together. At the same time, the threats to humanitarian aid organizations working in conflict areas such as Sudan and, of course, other concerns at the moment in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, in northern Uganda, simply many areas around the world where the protection of simply being an impartial, independent aid agency seems to be failing, and aid workers are at risk. It is very dangerous to do this kind of work.
Is Oxfam thinking about pulling out?
We are not at the moment, no. Oxfam is continuing to do its work, partly because we're working in some different areas, and the situation that we face is different on a daily basis. At the moment, we're benefiting over 520,000 people in Darfur. We're working in some of the largest camps, including Kalma in South Darfur, which has received tens of thousands of recent people in the past few weeks coming in, fleeing, fighting that's going on in South Darfur at the moment. And we are committed to continuing that work. Of course, we're very concerned about the deteriorating security situation, and we will be monitoring that very closely in the coming weeks.
We just have 30 seconds left with you, but I want to ask, one of the commitments the government in Sudan made, in Khartoum there made, was that it would no longer get in the way of aid operations to Darfur. Are they living up to that?
There has been some lifting of the bureaucratic restrictions on the delivery of aid that made it so difficult in the early months of the conflict. Of course, there's more that needs to be done, and lifting visa restrictions and expanding the opportunities for humanitarian agencies to have free and unhindered access will go a long way to helping us do this job.
Adrian McIntyre, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Adrian McIntyre is an aid worker in Sudan for Oxfam, the international aid organization. We reached him in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. When we come back from a break, we'll be talking about the issues that engage the United States, the European Union, and the world in Darfur. What kind of pressures can be put on to improve the situation? Our number, again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the humanitarian crisis in Darfur, which many people describe as genocide, and the latest developments in talks to end the violence there. What do you think the U.S., Europe, and the rest of the world should be doing to forge peace in Darfur? Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us to give some context to the situation in Sudan now is John Prendergast, Director of African Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now with the International Crisis Group and was last in Darfur in September. And it's nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
What do you make of today's announcement that suspended the peace talks between the rebels and the government?
Well, we're going to see this kind of a cycle of interrupted peace processes for quite some time. We saw the same thing for the other peace process that you referred to earlier, the process that deals with the southern-based rebels. Whenever either side, or in this case multiple parties, whenever one of them has an agenda that it does not include talking at the moment and would prefer fighting, we're going to see these kinds of interruptions. So it's going to be a truncated process, a very rough road for peace talks going forward on Darfur.
Mm-hmm. As we heard earlier, it's the African Union that's been given the lead in this situation, at least at the moment. How effective have they been?
Well, I think that their engagement in this is to be lauded. They've stepped in where the world largely turned away. And as Jonas said at the outset, this is a bit of a test case for them. It's an embryonic organization, the African Union, very early on in its life.
The successor to the old Organization of African Unity.
Right, and it's a remarkable thing, actually, that the international community would just sort of subcontract this negotiations process to such a young organization. I think there clearly is an abdication of responsibility here in the face of genocide, in the face of the kinds of atrocities that have been committed in Darfur, to just leave it in effect to a fledgling group like the African Union to try to sort out is rather remarkable in the absence of any kind of a potent response.
Is there a relationship between these two sets of peace negotiations that are going on at the same time? And again, the North-South trying to end that 21-year-old civil war and the other talks involving Darfur.
Yeah, the fact that they weren't related for so long is the remarkable thing. We saw a peace process unfold over the last 4 years dealing with the southern-based rebels that did not include or allow any other faction or group in the country to be part of the process. And now this is not a North-South war, as everyone calls it. It has been a war always of the center, a very small clique in the center, against a number of groups in the periphery of the country, including the South, including the West in Darfur and in the East. And the fact that they were all excluded from that and it was just a bipolar negotiation, a bilateral negotiation, meant that resentments were fueled while the negotiations unfolded with the southern-based rebels. And in fact, were part and parcel of the rationale for the conflict erupting in Darfur was the success, or at least the appearance of success in the negotiations with the southern rebels. So we have now have ties been forged between those that are negotiating with the southern-based rebels and those that are negotiating with the Darfurian rebels. And it's way too late, and it's, I think, symptomatic of how little the international community has invested beyond rhetoric in resolving the problems in Sudan.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. And Abdul joins us from Minneapolis.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, I got a question and a comment. My question is, my comment is that when the UN and the U.S. Have been working on this Darfur issue, I think earlier this year, and making the announcement that there's a genocide going on in Sudan, that there should have been an action followed by that. And what I mean by that is that the U.S. and the UN should come up with who is first committing the genocide. They should identify that and condemn those actions.
Okay. And a question, Abdul?
And my question is, why when something like this happens, why the suffering of the Sudanese people or the suffering of any African people is not made, it's not based on the decisions when the U.S. and the Europeans and the U.N. are taking actions? Why they only focus on the political issue but not base their decisions on the facts?
On the humanitarian issue, yes.
Yeah, on the humanitarian issue, like the Oxfam gentleman was all the things that he was...
Let's get a response from John Prendergast.
Well, Abdul really has hit the nail on the head. When you call something a genocide, in fact, this was the first time that a genocide, as it was ongoing, was called a genocide by a government, the United States, it's almost a desecration of the Genocide Convention to talk that talk and then not walk the walk. The Genocide Convention requires signatory states. It compels signatory states to do all they can to prevent and to punish the crime of genocide. That's what it says. It doesn't spell out specific actions. It just gives that general guidance. And what has happened as this genocide has unfolded over the last 20 months in Darfur is that not one punitive action has been taken against the perpetrator, the government that's responsible for organizing and orchestrating the acts that have been that have constituted the genocide. And it's quite remarkable that given that the Bush administration has indeed made that dramatic step and called it genocide, they haven't backed it up with specific actions. They haven't they haven't even proposed placing an arms embargo on the government of Sudan. The government continues to import tremendous amounts of arms and deploy those arms at the service of its military strategy in Darfur. It's a gap between rhetoric and action that definitely comes close to what we saw in 1994 in Rwanda.
The U.S. does have sanctions on Sudan. I mean, these are not American arms that are going to Sudan.
Yeah, the sanctions were imposed on Sudan in 1997, as a result of terrorism, the support for terrorist groups and actions that the Sudan government was engaged in at that time. So we haven't seen any new escalation, in other words, new effort within the UN Security Council to multilateralize these unilateral sanctions. Mm-hmm. So we have at this point now 4 out of the 5 members of the UN Security Council either selling arms to the government of Sudan or brokering arms deals, the United States being the lone non-participant in that but not willing to stand up to it. We have 4 out of the 5 members, permanent members of the Security Council, who are involved in the oil sector in Sudan, and the U.S. being the lone one that is not, but unwilling to really make a stand against what some of these people are doing to profit from the horrors that occur in Sudan. So we have a fairly significant international divisions unfolding in on the question of what to do about Sudan. And the one country that people look to say, okay, if there is going to be some action, it's going to be led by the United States, and the U.S. hasn't been willing to expend the diplomatic capital that it has, the leverage that it has on Sudan, because it's saving that for Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Al is with us from Eugene, Oregon.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I would like to know really what are the reasons behind this, but at the same time, from what I saw in the news, they both are Muslims, the group there, and they both speak Arabic, so I'm wondering, and they look African, so why not call them either Africans or Arabs? And at the same time, you know, not far from there is the Palestinian thing. Why don't we see exactly the same thing? Because that's how the Palestinians were driven out of their home, exactly the way you described in Darfur. But then it devolved into taking land through the sophisticated mechanism of called settlements and dividing the area with roads. Mm-hmm. I'd like to...
Why don't we stick to Darfur just for the moment?
Okay, well, it's the same thing. You know, I'd like to see justice done everywhere, not just in Darfur, but in the Palestinian and Tibet and everywhere. And my point is, what is really behind this? Why then they call them either African or Arabs? And what is the reason? Is it like resources? Is it water? Is it grazing land? What's really cooking there?
Al, thank you.
You bet.
Well, I think, Al, that what we have here is a phenomenon that we've seen all over the world. When a government, an authoritarian government, takes power through military means, it will maintain that power by any means necessary. And in the case of Sudan, those means have been some of the deadliest we've seen since the Second World War. I think all of the people in Darfur, all the people in Sudan, are African. and would describe themselves as that. But there are derivations of from Arab communities that and people that are from non-Arab origins as well. And there are certainly intercommunal divisions that fall along those lines. But those are not the fundamental divisions that have led to war in Darfur. I think what it is, in effect, is a struggle for power and a struggle for wealth and a small clique of people that have maintained almost exclusive control over the power, the reins of the state and the economic opportunities that come with that, and a number of groups around the country struggling to have a say in that, in those decisions. And I think you're going to get that kind of a phenomenon to continue until power-sharing deals are struck, regardless of the ethnicities and religions of the people involved in fighting.
The next caller is Colin, and Colin's calling from Athens, Ohio.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say one thing. It's like basically Khartoum has done is taken or gone back to the same textbook that they've been using in the South as far as the militia and the killings of, you know, civilians and things like that, you know, creating situations where they shoot up food distribution centers just to create disarray. But I think what one of the most important questions worth asking is that Khartoum as a government does not talk to anybody. And somehow there's this blind faith that everybody keeps to put on Khartoum. Why that is the case, I don't understand. Could you shed some more light on this, John?
Well, I think one of the devices that Khartoum has used to maintain that exclusive power is, in fact, to undertake multiple negotiating tracks so that each and every one of these individual groups that are fighting against it throughout the country are engaged in some way or another in some kind of a diplomatic process that is facilitated by different mediators. So we have the Egyptian government mediating with a certain group of opposition. We have the African Union led by the Nigerians negotiating with another set of factions from Darfur. And then we have a third track of negotiations in the South, which is led by the neighboring countries in East Africa. So you have all these different disparate negotiating tracks that the government simply divides one against the other. And the international community, having very little time to really invest in trying to pull together a comprehensive strategy, has been played like a violin by the authorities in Khartoum. The authorities there are focusing on this 24 hours a day. We're looking at it at 6, 7, 8 hours a day, and we're being very, very badly outplayed. And I think at this time, we have to have a more comprehensive vision of where do we want to see Sudan in the next 5 years, and then putting all of those various negotiating tracks into one single approach that drives towards a comprehensive settlement, a comprehensive peace settlement for Sudan as a whole.
Thank you very much for the call. And I did want to ask earlier, what kind of leverage does the United States, or the outside world for that matter, have with the government in Khartoum?
Well, I think the government in Khartoum is very, very interested in playing a larger role than just being that government. It has, for years, desired to play a major role in the Middle East peace process, in brokering negotiations between other countries. It has a desire to play a role beyond itself. And I think that the isolation, that partial isolation that it has felt because of U.S. pressures has given the United States additional leverage. In other words, when Khartoum does what it's supposed to do, stops killing its own people and signs the peace deals and starts implementing them, then it will come out from under the isolating measures that the United States has imposed on it over the last few years, over the last 10 years.
Right.
So I think that's one of the things. There's IMF and World Bank funding that they seek because of the economic problems. There's a number of things that they would like to have.
John Prendergast, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Prendergast, former Director of African Affairs on the National Security Council in the Clinton administration, now a special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now is Ambassador Michael Raneberger, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the State Department. And we know you've been involved in other phone calls. We appreciate your time to break away and talk with us.
Yes, I'm delighted to have the opportunity.
At this point, what political or diplomatic obstacles are there that prevent the United States from putting more pressure on the government in Khartoum regarding Darfur?
Well, what's important to point out here is that we've been putting an enormous amount of pressure on Darfur now for quite a number of months. We're doing that at the same time that we are pressing the Sudanese government and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement to sign the separate peace agreement between the North and the South. In our view, the two things are related. Pressure must be kept on all parties to achieve peace in the entire country.
As you know, your critics say you're so focused on that North-South treaty that you were ignoring the situation in Darfur.
Right. And, of course, that really isn't accurate. If you look very quickly at what we've done on Darfur, of course, the Secretary of State was in Darfur in June. He provided a number of requests to the government of Sudan to take. We have sponsored two resolutions in the United Nations Security Council that provided for the possibility of punitive measures. We have spoken out. The president himself has spoken out very strongly on this issue, and we are in frequent contact with the highest levels of the Sudanese government, as well as, I might add, the Darfur rebel groups. We brokered a ceasefire in Abuja between the rebel groups and the government. Admittedly, that has not worked, but we also then took the lead to ask the African Union to monitor the situation in Darfur, have provided U.S. military airlift to get African troops into Darfur, and have committed hundreds of millions of dollars for humanitarian assistance to Darfur, as well as over $40 million at this point to support the African Union monitoring mission. So we've done really an enormous amount.
An enormous amount, as you say, but if you call it genocide, is that enough?
Well, the Secretary of State made that determination after looking at all of the evidence, and that is our position. The question that you ask, of course, is I don't think one has ever done enough until a situation like that has been stopped. On the other hand, we feel that we have put in place steps that can bring about an end to the violence. The expansion, the rapid expansion of the African Union Monitoring Mission, there should be well over 1,000 personnel on the ground by the end of this year.
Should they be authorized to intervene to protect people, civilians?
Yes, their expanded mandate, and I think this is significant, the expanded mandate that the African Union itself approved about a month or so ago does provide for them to intervene if they see civilians in imminent danger. Now, of course, they have limited personnel at this point. As I say, they should be over 1,000 by the end of this month. Their goal is to ramp up to about 3,500, possibly go beyond that if necessary. One of the things I think has been very important in this whole effort is that the United States and the European Union and other countries around the world have worked together in very tight coordination to provide the support for the African Union efforts. And as I say, to pass these resolutions in the Security Council and to maintain very strong pressure on both sides. So this is a very important multilateral effort that we're engaged in.
Ambassador, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador Michael Ranneberger, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the State Department. He joined us by phone from here in Washington. When we come back from a break, a look at a genocide 10 years ago, Hotel Rwanda.